and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Anne Lauterbach. Anne Lauterbach is the author of 6 collections of poetry, If in Time, Selected Poems, 1975 to 2000, published by Penguin in 2001, On a Stair, published in 1997, and For Example, published in 1994, Clamor, published in 1991, Before Recollection, published by Princeton University Press in 1987, and Many Times But Then, published by the University of Texas Press in 1979. Her 7th collection, entitled Hum, also by Viking Penguin, will be published in the spring of 2005, as will The Night Sky, a collection of her prose writings. She has received fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation, the Ingram Merrill Foundation, and the John D. and Catherine C. MacArthur Foundation. Since 1991, she has taught at Bard College, where she is a David and Ruth Schwab III Professor of Languages and Literature and Director of Writing in the Milton Avery Graduate School of the Arts. She was born and raised in New York City, and we're excited to have her here as a guest of the Ellis School in Pittsburgh. Welcome.
Thank you.
Great to have you. You're going to just begin with some poems.
Okay. I thought I'd start with what I now think of as an early poem from my second book, the title poem called Before Recollection. I thought of it because it's a love poem, and the spring has been very delayed. Before Recollection. Here we begin, not to let purposes transcend making, all day in the shadow of, and then to propose a critical approach to love or color or the vindictive aspects of spring. Descent is optional even as we twine in the vicinity of grace, an aspect of mourning, hoping to find someone to help the heart without question. There is another morning when we twine in the center of grace, helpless, and find emblems for now and dream somewhat. What is yours is mine, stacked against the season as allowance without thrift. So the requiem lifts hours to the sky, dilutes rose, then dries into night. You say there is some place like never, but these trees resemble a former green, held in abeyance, branched, becoming inordinate. The second poem is from the next book called Clamor, and it's called The French Girl. It's a poem I'm fond of because it's the beginning of a kind of breaking up of the syntax in the work, and it was written in memory of my sister Jennifer. The French Girl. Someone plays, and the breaking mounts. Raw material for worthy forthcoming, indecipherable, discreet. Plays rhapsodies as the air cools and vanquishes. Nothing sits still yet. The land is a result of its use, I explained. Everything else rested while the kids made a girdle removed from classical syntax. Shed and something breaks, mounting the small hill to its vista. I saw a rope of trees in another country. I could not say I am lost in the proper way. The season is huge. This house is haunted. I planted it. Where? In the shed, and spoiled by attention. You see, every bit counts when the morning displays the serious ratio of the given stars. What made us tear the hours into lines, so things became a burden to shed, and astute as a hungry pilgrim, but not brave, not expert. It is impolite to stare, is unwise to plunder the easily forgotten, easily shed, and they drummed and drummed, attached to a vestigial clamor. The heat splayed, sparklers ravished the fog. Morning tore the dead back to shore. Enemy ships floundered and were forgotten. Still nothing was appeased. The living silhouette drifted into view like an ephemeral sail promoting ease between wreckages. Not speaking a word of English, she animated the landscape with abundance, a chosen self freely translated into the color of her eyes. Awkward and luminous, a stilted charm separating figure from ground and solving it. What pushed us toward the abysmal was such new appraisals, such sure interest. The mute girl had seen glories. But what did she come to know? A finite figure in a rainy field, a naked figure in a pool, a skipping figure across a bridge, a lost figure on a city street, a moaning figure on a huge bed, a smiling face in a photograph. All summer, I circled the garden for her sake. And I'm going to read next from another poem that I have a certain affection for, although it's very dark. Well, it's dark and light. It's called Harm's Way, Arm's Reach. And I think of this poem often because it was written just after the first attempt on the World Trade Center. I live in New York, about six blocks from the Trade Center. And I'd gone away on a trip to Europe and come back, and just at the moment I came back, there was this emergency in the neighborhood. And not only that, but somebody had cut the tree in the back of my loft. And so the tree had been wounded in a way that was, those of you who live in cities know how precious trees are. So if you have one tree and it's been mutilated, it is like a person. It's called Harm's Way, Arm's Reach. Things are not cured by resilience. Thrash, thrash, wept the amputated limb, unable to lean, starved of its hair. A group of men wanted to avenge, to truncate the city, to make everyone scream. On the bateau, in wild heat, children laughed through the history lesson, through the great facades in the year of friendly fire. The friend looked away, subverting fate because of the wound, saying, "I disapprove of the personality of the street which cannot be arranged. Henceforth, two out of three curtains must be closed." In fiction's unhinged seat, in the hesitant new, resting under a shadow, unbodied in febrile need, and from afar, far in that land, song of the first bird, pressure in the throat, gospel devoted to mercy, a zone or hinge out of the discursive enclosure, long frieze of furious goddesses, wrath of the drunken boy, in the home for depraved girls, in the department of recent arrivals. My name is an unsolved equation. I come toward you. I ask you to meet me at twilight in the unfinished part of the story, in the small grotto, in the room with giraffes and a man with a string, when it is raining, when all the maps are spread on the desk, where the towels, where the nest fell. I write to you from the place of habit, but today I am young. I am merely a slant, perpetually drawn into spelling. My name is a tall man who walks along the street of books in the year of the mouth who has not forgotten how to kiss. The friend says, "But in order to fix it, you must have a sense of prior perfection." She says, "Light, beauty, fire." I say, "Toward and rage of the weed and etymology and starvation." I say, "The change or revolution that does not produce the conclusion or final event. Catastrophe as definition, the wall that was." Where we come from abides as choice. It is the way of a vowel. Have you remembered to take all your belongings with you? Today, all distance is summer. If you open the curtains, you will see the evil wires, the broken lock, the rifles, the plot, dark crevices of diminished weight, the lesson of the open hand, your mother's maiden name. You will hear a cluster of pilgrims undaunted by speed, flagrant as any transparency, the indelible scheme of the wish, a parade for no reason, an apricot thud where the limb was.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Anne Lauterbach. I wanted to ask you about what you mentioned about the breakup of syntax in your work, the reaching a point where you started to do that. How did you come to that point, and like how did you come to the breaking, and was it exhilarating when you first did it?
Yeah, it was exhilarating because I realized that in the early work I had tried very hard to make a form that had a kind of internal coherence. And I love syntax, and I think it's really capable of doing anything. So it wasn't about rejecting syntax. It was about wanting to open it up so that various other kinds of things could happen that were different from a certain logic. I think poetry has a different logic than rhetoric, for example. And so I thought, I can break it up, and that breaking will turn into another kind of rhythmic space that will leave these gaps. And the gaps became very precious to me because they're not only silences, obviously, but they're also places of invisible apprehension or settlement or any of the ways in which one can think of the pause, you know. And then I've come to this place where I find a certain comfort in fragments, because I realized I think when people die in your life who were not meant to die, not that people are, but when people die before they're old, I think what happens is you begin to see that the narratives are not the ones that you expected, and if you live a certain amount of time, you see that the narrative is not what you expected. So maybe you could begin to think about the way narrativity works differently from a set of relations that are because this happened, this cause effect. So what I was trying to do is to open the poems so that they weren't in that kind of relation to each other. I mean, there's still sort of profound relationships that happen, but they're not the same as the ones that are purely syntactic.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's sort of interesting that you refer to, you know, what's happening in real life, that you sort of refer to a sense of the real as a way to explain, you know, the abstract. And because I wanted to ask you about the real, I was wondering, I had a feeling that you were almost saying through some of your poems, that we are victims of a sense of, in a sense, of the real. Hmm. Since even if we are aware of its faulty presentation, that it's what surrounds us, it's part of what we work with.
Hmm. It's a really nice question. Victims of the real. The notion that there is something called reality and that it has a single dimension is disturbing to me, because I think reality is so multitudinous and so profoundly unknowable that to, in some way, to use the kind of classic word, commodify the real, is a sort of prison. And the way in which we think of the real in this culture, I think, has a lot to do with mimesis or resemblance. If something looks like something, we think it's real. But I think there are a lot of other ways for reality to come toward us that are not just in the kind of image, the kind of barrage of images. And I've thought for a long time about the problem of the relationship between the real, as you're talking about it, or we're talking about it, and the true. And I've come to realize that, or thought about, I don't think this is original with me, but it took me a long time to get to this path in a way, which was that the opposite of the real is the fictive, the imagination. So if you pin the real to something that doesn't allow for imaginative acts, then your interpretive abilities for dealing with your own reality becomes very sort of truncated. And the opposite of the true is the false. So if you align the true and the false with the real and the fictive, you get a kind of strange shape. And what I want to do is sort of is to make a kind of diagonal, if you see that as a square, where the true and the fictive are allied to each other, because the fictive is the imagined, and the imagined is often more true in the sense, in the moral sense or in the ethical sense, than the real. Mm-hmm. But this is a culture that wants to think that because of jurisprudence, I mean, there are a lot of reasons for it, witnessing, we have a kind of dedication to things being true because they're real, because they really happened. Mm-hmm. But there's another kind of truth that comes out of the imagination, which is valuable and important and useful in dealing with, you know, this sort of odd, amorphous thing that one might call the real. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't have a television anymore, but I saw a little piece of a reality show, or so-called reality show, the other day, and I was really quite horrified by it. One doesn't have to get pompous and pious about it. I just thought it had nothing to do with the real. Mm-hmm. So I didn't even understand. I think that it must mean something about the possibility of real time and the possibility of something spontaneous happening, but nothing spontaneous was happening. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anyway, yeah.
Okay. We covered a lot of ground there.
Yes. Yeah, sorry about okay. that.
No, no, it's good. Dissertation. It's all good. Could you read some more poems?
Yes. Please? Maybe I'll jump to more recent, some more recent work from my new manuscript. This one's called, well, this one actually is quite syntactical, so you see, I'll just talk against myself. It's called Victory. Reverence for that dust. The scale is overwhelming. I cannot envision this ever getting done. They took a lot away from us. World rattles its harness. Among, within us, too many injuries, as if in caves, in mountains, in snow. The train whistled a thing of air, and the corral also ceased. Night took over even as the moon came up blushing and round to lead us on. The philosopher with the poker was in a rage. Sebald perished in a crash. I looked up to find the stars rambling across the sky, and that morning the starlings, I have nothing to say about starlings. The body does not appear. Enthusiastically, the guitar strums. Shoes wander, vertiginous ascent, pathology of disorder in which nothing is under the overlay of a high velocity near. The kids are on their snowmobiles. I could kill them. I could speak of killing the kids and not mean it. I could kill the snowmobiles and ask the kids to look at the copulating dolls hung with threads and then at solace. If recurrence is form, who sighs at the spoken? Ah, 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 the anecdotal takes sunset and moonrise into a regime. To speak outside the retrofit of a target's eye, blinking, hands waving as the ship pulls out. Empathy like a shadow on an object's pyre, the object's stench as the crowd presses to climb the platform, snap the shutter, watch it burn. Duration slit open, whiplash speed rising over the skull as an idea, any idea, say a mask, and the shreds now catapulting our pleasure into this fissure or slit through the eye perpetuates its claim, and all it sees is limitless enunciation, limitless screen, undone by the actual yet called up by readiness, cloth, snow, page, trees at dusk ready to disappear. The monochrome tugs at its frame. The news will not assuage, greets the about turn reckoned as victory's norm or sample contingent. In wartime, the reporters eat in or at the house of the vanquished. This is called Elegy in August. This It's odd. It's an odd poem. It came from many different directions, as many of my poems do. They settle out of a number of different prior events, so they're never directly in relation to a single event. And one of the events in this was actually being asked by Brenda Hillman, poet Brenda Hillman, to give her a poem with a garden in it, because she knows I love to garden. So there is a sort of garden motif in it. Elegy in August. Guess again at the brown bird's queue. It is dry. It is dry again, and so also still dry. So dry, it could be a French repetition, not weather at all. These filmic follies, these skirmishes decor of the flat-chested actress with thin lips. Enhancement of the singular does not count, or else this is an event among thieves and the women who belong to the thieves. So dry, so many, so common, the twilight brown bird, the accretion of musical numbers, counting so. But garden, only hymns and slight poems to praise you to your grave, but garden. We were there. We listened. Michael had been invited to a convocation. He is adored in other countries. Michael, only hymns and slight poems, only counted stones, but garden. And yet, in the heady nomenclature of the newly dead, there are forgotten words. Hollyhock, cornflower, foxglove. I dare you to unplant the daisies under glass. Only white flowers grow. But Michael, mes jardins, angel, is a season coming next or easily stranded with the worried bird, the brown bird, twilight, the white flame? Is reason coming? Is this your curtain? To be so lovingly displayed as Michael's worth, lilies, Queen Anne's lace, with the night-eyed ghost, planted these. Is it your garden? Stone arch, bed, broken root. Is it your garden? Your twilight? The roses were stolen from China with tea.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Anne Lauterbach. I wanted to ask you about air, the air in your work. You had said that as time went on, your poems, there was more space, more openness. And yet, in your early poems, it seemed to me that there was a lot of air in them, as in movement, places to go between ideas. And it seemed to me that the idea of dimension is really important in your work. And as you said, the settling of different events into one poem. So this material world that appears in your work, I think, it seems to be rife with air and movement from what is unseen. Mm-hmm. Would you agree with that? Or?
Well, air, it's such a great, it's another wonderful question, because, of course, the breath is air, and the song comes from the breath. I'm very interested in voice, I think, as part of a poem, the voicing of a poem, the voice in the poem, that's part of it. But also air is this kind of connective tissue, which is really, I think, what you're talking about, something that's actually it is a kind of material that you can float the world in, or the world floats in this air, this atmosphere, or this environment. And it is a kind of sustaining in the most profound sense of the sort of sustenance of us, is this airspace. I think there's a will in my poems to resist definition, or to resist category, or resist anything that it feels to me like a kind of sucking away of the air, you know, a kind of constraint. Sometimes to the point of folly, you know, the poems sometimes just fall apart in my will to have them free, in a sense, to give them freedom. Mm-hmm. And there's always a tension between wanting to give them that freedom and wanting to restrain them so that the reader gets something. You know, there's that kind of sense. But happily, I've come to be very, to feel very, very easy about
what it is that a reader might get. You know, even if it's only a piece of it, it's fine with me. I don't feel that the whole poem has to be gotten in the normative sense of getting, you know, understanding. I think understanding is actually quite overrated, you know, as in making sense. I think there are other things that don't make sense, you know. Falling in love doesn't make sense. So I think it's important. Beauty doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. So these are values that I think are worth holding out for.
Right, right. As a reader of your poems and a listener, I have this great feeling of room to move around. And so it's maybe not only what you want as a writer, but what I get, which is I'm really happy about that there's room and many ways to go. So I don't feel constrained, which is good.
There's one of the things that I often say in relation to this work, or because these poems often are in parts, when you say room to move around, I sometimes think of them as a kind of strange architecture. So that you're in one room and then there's a little tiny hallway and then you're in another room and then you're in another. So you're sort of wandering around in this sort of somewhat capacious house, a certain kind of house or housing. It's a landscape that is both inside and outside. It doesn't really have very much sense of itself as necessarily interior. Mm-hmm. But it is often interior in a kind of bodily sense or material sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it feels collapsible in every way.
Yes, collapsible. Perfect.
And you can think you're here and then you're there and then that's fine.
Right, right. Like Henry James does that. You know, when you read Henry James, the great syntactical master of all time, you feel when you read him that you're wandering around almost inside of language. You know, mm-hmm. you don't know where you are other than in his language.
Right.
I find that very thrilling.
Yeah. Okay, we have time for a shorter poem if you have one.
I'll read you, I think it's short enough, I hope. This is the title poem of the collection, and it's called Hum, H-U-M, and it was written shortly after 9/11, and I was there on that morning, so this is what I came up with. Hum. The days are beautiful. The days are beautiful. I know what days are. The other is weather. I know what weather is. The days are beautiful. Things are incidental. Someone is weeping. I weep for the incidental. The days are beautiful. Where is tomorrow? Everyone will weep. Tomorrow was yesterday. The days are beautiful. Tomorrow was yesterday. Today is weather. The sound of the weather is everyone weeping. Everyone is incidental. Everyone weeps. The tears of today will put out tomorrow. The rain is ashes. The days are beautiful. The rain falls down. The sound is falling. The sky is a cloud. The days are beautiful. The sky is dust. The weather is yesterday. The weather is yesterday. The sound is weeping. What is this dust? The weather is nothing. The days are beautiful. The towers are yesterday. The towers are incidental. What are these ashes? Here's the hat that does not travel. Here is the robe that smells of the night. Here are the words retired to their books. Here are the stones loosed from their settings. Here is the bridge over the water. Here is the place where the sun came up. Here is a season dry in the fireplace. Here are the ashes. The days are beautiful.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The poetry of Anne Lauterbach. Beautiful poem. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Sound engineers are Joel Grimes, R. Joseph Wilk, and John Belch. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, radio made possible with member support. 91.3 WYEP.